Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University College of Health and Rehabilitation Sciences Sargent College. Our speaker is Lee Woodruff, wife of ABC News correspondent Bob Woodruff. Mrs. Woodruff's lecture is titled, Life Changes in an Instant, A Caregiver's Journey. We begin with an introduction by Sargent College Dean Gloria Waters.
Lee Woodruff is a best-selling author, and she was a contributor to ABC's Good Morning America. In 2007, she co-authored a New York Times number one bestseller with her husband, Bob, which chronicles her husband and her family's journey after Bob suffered a traumatic brain injury when he was embedded with the military in Iraq. Their experience led them to establish the Bob Woodruff Foundation, which is helping wounded servicemen and their families who are still on the road to recovery. So we're really delighted to have Lee here today to tell us about her experiences and to share this with us. Thank you.
Thank you. I've been running so fast, I have just a little intro video that I neglected to bring, and you're never supposed to tell people what they're not going to see, but the reason I'm telling you is I think what I'll do is I'll quickly kind of go through the history of what happened to us, because what I really want to focus on more for you all is the perspective of the family and of the caregiver and the ways in which you touched me, the ways in which you inspired me and my husband, and the things that I have done and seen and witnessed that I feel I can share with you in hopes that perhaps it will help you do what you do better. Because at the end of the day, when you go home from school or you go home from the hospital, it is your job. Like, you are allowed to be a little bit pissy some days, right? Maybe you fought with your mother in the morning, or your boyfriend left his underwear 2 inches from the laundry basket and you're really sick of picking it up. Whatever it may be, this is your job. So you're allowed to walk into your job and have a bad day. But my message to you is this: your bad day, I mean, you're not the person answering in India answering my mean call to Con Ed about why my bill, is underpaid. You have such an impact in what you do, and that tiny moment that you intersect with me or my children or my husband could make the entire difference on how I continue to go about the rest of my day. And whether or not I have the energy or the strength or any last drop of juice left in my body to get up the next morning and do it again. So in my mind, that makes you guys sort of somewhere up kind of on Mount Olympus. And that's a really big and wonderful and important and responsible position to hold. And I think sometimes people forget that one moment where maybe you put your hand on my shoulder and say, how are you today, Mrs. Woodruff? That moment can send me skipping off like that little Lucky Charms elf for the rest of the day because somebody thought about me, somebody put me into the equation, and I'm the person ultimately, especially with a brain injury, who is really directing and directing in the sense of an orchestra, the entire care and the world around which my loved one operates. And so for him to get better, I need to get better. And for me to get better, I need to see, as I go through my day in the rehab hospital with him or without him, one drop of kindness. And that's the one thing that I found in all of the journeys that we made through our rehab world. Bob was named the co-anchor of World News in 2006. That was after Peter Jennings died. I know most of you guys don't watch the news anymore, you young things, but there only used to be three networks at one point in time. And one of those networks was ABC, still is. And Bob took over with a woman named Elizabeth Vargas after Peter died. And the idea was that one person would be in the field reporting and one would be sort of in the studio, and they would flip-flop a little bit, but I knew it would be Bob mostly who would be the person who would be out in the field, because that's what he had loved to do. We wrote a book called In an Instant. It's the story, as Gloria said, of the injury and the recovery. But it's really the story of a marriage. It's a back and forth about our life, about our journey. You can read all the millions of places we lived, being in Tiananmen Square, how Bob got into journalism. I actually married a lawyer. And I contend that really to understand how a family survives something so cataclysmic, you really need to look at how the foundation was built. And so what it ends up being, too, I think, is a book that that just shows the underpinnings of how you make it through something so incredibly awful and so completely out of the blue. Bob was in Iraq in January for his ninth time. He had covered wars for probably a good 10 years. So he was no stranger to places of conflict. And when he left to go to this, at this point in reporting, it was President Bush's State of the Union address. And he was going to talk about how our troops were standing down and we had been training the coalition forces to take over and do more patrolling. So he was there for 2 days. He was going to embed really quickly with the military and go down and report about the safety of some of these areas that had been incredibly insurgent active. And what happened to Bob as he was riding down that road in and out on top of the tank is what happens to our troops every single day in Iraq and Afghanistan. A 155-millimeter shell, which is about from me to that first chair, exploded off a little bit to Bob's left. And so Bob was, the force of a bomb like that, a roadside bomb, is three times the force of a tsunami or a hurricane at the highest level. So that kind of power, that kind of blast of air, and it comes in a wave, a shock wave, which was actually strong enough to shatter Bob's skull. A rock had knocked his helmet off. Rocks and dirt came up out of the ground with a bomb. And one rock cut through his chin strap, blew his helmet off. The blast of air, this is how they think it happened. I mean, it's hard to recreate this stuff in a moment of war. But the blast of air shattered his skull on the left temporal lobe over the Broca's area, region of his brain. And that rock continued all the way through his neck and came to rest on the carotid artery on the other side of his neck. So there are so many incredible miracles surrounding Bob's recovery, certainly. But there are many surrounding his injury as well. Literally hundreds of rocks flew into his head and neck. There are three rocks went up under his armhole of his flak jacket and shattered his scapula. But there are little rocks, there were and still are, around his eyeball. But for whatever reason, no rock perforated his eyeball. He still has one in his eyelid. And for many, many months after his injury, those rocks, like shrapnel does, would work their way up through the skin, and he would, you know, call my little twins over and say, okay, guys, come squeeze one out. And I really was the only wife that I knew in Westchester County who could say that my husband really did have rocks in his head. So that was an honest thing. Humor is a huge, huge balm. And you may see things in the hospital that you just think, who are those crazy people? And how can they be laughing over this man's comatose body? Well, gallows humor has to have been around since the gallows and probably before. And so there were so many moments that we were so inappropriate about so many things. We called Bob half head. We had so many jokes about, you know, what was happening under the sheets and how many nurses were really checking out the family jewels and all that stuff. And I think there were moments that people sort of looked at us and thought, wow, those people are crazy. That was our survival mechanism. That was our coping mechanism. And if we couldn't laugh, then what was before us, the sight before us, would have been so completely horrible that you need those moments to just feel those endorphins. There's a wonderful book by Norman Cousins called Anatomy of an Illness, and it's an older book, so I don't know how many people read this book anymore. But he literally was in a hospital. I think he was here in Boston, was he not? And he was ill with something that no one could define. They couldn't figure out what it was. And he realized that a hospital really wasn't a great place to get better. It was a bummer. People were interrupting you all the time. You couldn't sleep. The food stunk. And he decided that what he was going to do was look at reruns of Candid Camera over and over again and make himself laugh and try to heal himself that way. You need to read this book because it's pretty. He ends up getting better. Nobody knows why he was sick. Nobody knows why he got better. But I believe in the power of laughter. So should you see people doing very bizarre things, hula dancing over somebody's bed, you just walk on by and you just say whatever it's going to take to make these people laugh. That's a healthy, incredible thing. Well, Bob fell back in the tank after the injury, and he hit his head on the back of the tank, and so he has a sort of a pie-shaped wedge out of his vision on the left side, probably from hitting his optic nerve on the back. He fell down, and he describes and still can remember that feeling that so many describe of a near-death experience, of floating above his body and being bathed in that white light, that people talk about. And to him, he felt like that was heaven, and that's what happens when you die. And it still to this day has erased his fear of death. I mean, he felt like that was actually a very comforting thing to experience, because if that's what it was going to feel like, it was going to feel warm and comforting and inviting. And for whatever reason, he woke up hard on the bottom of the tank, began kicking, began talking. Blood was just pouring out of the wound in his neck that the rock had created, and it was his Iraqi translator who screamed at Bob's producer to put his hand on his neck, put your hand on his neck, put your hand on his neck, to be able to stop the flow until they could get to Bob. His producer, Vinny, told me that he had spoken, that he was shouting about what he was going to do to these guys who had just blown the bomb up. And I thought that that was a really great sign. So I would hold on to that when I would talk to the docs in the ICU. Until one doctor, wah, wah, well, that was, there's no guarantee that he can talk now because he's had multiple surgeries since then. And how do we know that wasn't just a brainstem reaction? And I thought, really? You're going to take that one away from me too? Like, I'm kind of clinging on by a thread here. How about something a little bit positive? And that is my giant message to you all today, because as a family member witnessing this, what we do so wrong in the medical profession is we are so afraid of a lawsuit, so afraid that that wife's going to come back with her nails out to scratch my face because I've told her I think that this might be okay. We are so completely afraid of offering any hope in a medical situation that what we do is we beat those families and those caregivers down to such a low point that they have to reach inside themselves every single day just to figure out how you're going to find the energy to walk back in that ICU one more time. I sat with a panoply of doctors after Bob was taken from the tank to Baghdad, where he was assessed as critical. He was not expected to live. His wounds were very grave. He had lost a lot of blood. There just happened to not be anybody else as serious in the Baghdad cache at that point in time, or he would have been triaged to the back of the room. They then got him to Balad, which is where most of the neurosurgical work is done in this war, if you're in the Baghdad area. And that's a hospital made out of tents run by generators. The doctors and nurses are wearing full body armor, if you can imagine that, while they're operating. And while they were operating on Bob, they were actually taking mortar fire. So within 47 minutes from that war zone, they got 16 centimeters of Bob's skull off, and they knew exactly what to do. They didn't hesitate. The two sweet little medics who were 24 and 25, and Bob and I got a chance to meet them in Portland, actually ignored the radio, which told them to turn around. There was a complex gunfight down on the ground, and it was too dangerous to land. They ignored that order and landed the plane anyway, which to me is just an incredible example of the kinds of men and women who are serving, who have stood up to go in this war. Whether or not you believe in this war, whatever your politics are, it doesn't matter. These are the young men and women who are there because their country asked them to go. And those two guys who were willing to get in there and land are really part of the giant and amazing continuum of care that really allowed Bob to be back as a father and a husband and now back on the air at ABC as well. Bob was then flown to Landstuhl, Germany, which is the European theater for all of our base of operations in Europe and in the Middle East. And that's where I saw him. And it was a pretty horrifying sight. The left side of his face looked like he had been dragged, tied to the back of a bumper and dragged along a dirt road. His eye was completely mangled. His ear looked like it was gone. His face just looked like raw meat. And then there was this horrifying thing that I never knew could happen, that a brain could really swell that much outside of a skull, that there was this popover thing, this rugby ball on his head. And that was, to me, absolutely unbelievable. Nobody had prepared me for that. I remember it being really, really cold in the room, and that was to keep the swelling down. And I remember thinking, but his body's perfect. Everything about his body was absolutely perfect. I couldn't see the wound on his back because that would have to heal while he was lying on it. And I remember the nurse asking me if I was going to faint. I said, no, I'm not going to faint, but I need you to tell me what's happening. And she began to tell me, and I said, okay, stop. And I realized that what I needed as a family member was to parse the information slowly, to allow only the things I needed to allow into my head. And it was at that moment I decided that I would live in what I refer to in the book as the vortex. And the vortex was just my little black hole where no one else could come inside unless they had my permission. Because if I began to go on Google, if I began to ask people, well, tell me about this, what's this going to be like? And I began to hear all of the horrible pronouncements that I would later hear. I don't know what I would have done. I think I would have curled up in a little ball at some point and wondered how I was going to do this with four children. It was at that moment when we got back to Bethesda Naval Hospital. So the soldiers are transported on giant C-17 planes that are hollowed out, and instead of cargo, there are just stacks and stacks of beds. And so Bob came back, some of the incredible advancements now, because it would have taken somebody with a brain injury in Vietnam. First of all, Bob wouldn't have survived in Vietnam with the injuries that he had, but it would have taken about 76 days, his doctor told me, for someone to get stateside back then. And the injury rate back then was about 3 injured to 1 dead. And because of medical advancements and because of what we're able to do with brain injuries and do in the field, it's now about 13 injured to 1 dead in these wars, which means there are a lot of people coming home, a lot of people you will see and you will treat. And for those of you who are just getting out of school, who your generation will inherit, as ours inherited Vietnam, who will really need your help and who will really need your understanding about what's wrong, especially those with the hidden injuries, without the big scar that Bob has underneath his hair that runs from the front of his head to the back, but those who have suffered with post-traumatic stress disorder and combat stress, some of the things that in Vietnam and in previous wars we didn't even understand. We just called shell shock in World War II, and prior to that you probably didn't really survive. So there I was, sitting at the table, and all of these docs filed in. And they were every discipline you could imagine, maxillofacial, orthopedic, general surgeon, neurosurgeon, you name it, they were there to deal with Bob and to tell me, to give me the report. And the very first thing I remember was someone pushing the form over to me to sign. And it was the form for all the surgeries and the anesthesia, and it was basically the form that says, this man is yours. You are responsible for this human being. And although I had taken those vows 19 years earlier, and although I had thought about him dying in a war zone, I had never thought about disability. I had never thought that my young, smart, incredibly talented, strapping husband would be in this position. And I remember thinking, I'm 100% responsible for him. And even more bizarre, and I can still see this moment, and I think it's a moment that you need to watch for, too, because there are going to see so many tensions among family members in that situation. But here were my in-laws sitting across the table from me, whom I love and I'm very close to. But as the form came over to me, I could see his mother kind of going, but he's my little boy. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, oh, my gosh, this is just one of those sort of, you know, bizarre moments where we both love him, we both want the same thing, but it's all been brought home to me that everything is really on my shoulders, all the decisions, all the pressure, will I make the right decision? It was very obvious to me and to his parents at that moment in time that this was me, he was my responsibility. Well, let me get back to those docs. So each one of those docs gave me their pronouncement, and it was a lot of not going to be able to do, probably won't. We're pretty sure that we don't want to tell you that. And I looked around the room and I thought, wow, you know, I feel like a giant mallet has been hit over my head right now. And what's my motivation? Might as well just throw them in the vegetable aisle at Safeway, because that's what it sounds like where we're headed here. You can laugh, guys, okay? Vegetable aisle, Safeway. And I think that two things. I think that human beings are really intuitive. We're really smart people. And we certainly are smart people about our loved ones. So if it's 6 months down the road and Dad's stroke isn't going the way we want it to go, or maybe it's a year down the road and the radiation and the chemo haven't really worked on Mom's breast cancer, we are going to understand that. Our minds are going to ultimately let us understand that this is probably as good as Dad's going to be able to walk. Or this is as much language as, you know, Uncle Jim is going to get back. We're going to understand that. We don't need to have any bit of hope or ability for a miracle pulled out from under us on that very first night. That is the most debilitating thing anyone can do. But I don't want to overpromise, say the docs to me. We can't tell them something that we don't know what's going to happen. And so here's my answer to that. My answer is this. My answer is, then do what the nurses knew how to do with me. And I'll tell you what the nurses would do. nobody told me he's going to be 80%, he's going to be 100%. No one can give you those odds in a brain injury. This is not a broken bone. This is not cancer. This is the incredibly most awful, most paint-drying thing in the world to watch someone put it back together after a brain injury. What the nurses did is they told me stories. They would tell me a story about that guy, that boy, it didn't look like he was going to have a very good outcome, but let me tell you about him now. He's out in the playground with his kid. He got a job. Okay, maybe he's not doing what he was doing before, but he's got this fabulous job at the health club, and he's a trainer. Tell me a story. Tell that poor person who you're going to see with her shoulders down to her knees as she walks in the rehab place one more time. Tell her a story about something. You're not promising her anything. You're not telling her that that's going to be her husband. But everybody deserves to believe that they have a chance to be that one person who is a miracle. And if it's not a miracle, we're going to understand that. That's going to dawn on us slowly over time. But what right does anybody have to really beat somebody up at the early stages of this? We are so in shock, so in our grief when something like this happens. Because let's face it, most brain injuries happen from an in an instant moment. It's not the slow burn of feeling, slowly feeling the tumor and then finally realizing you better get in and get that scanned. These are usually moments where the phone interrupts a really perfect, kind of nice life, and all of a sudden there's a line between the before and the after. So for weeks, for months, God, for even like last week, I still had one of those, really? Did that happen moments? There is a shock. There is a sort of gauzy kind of thing that falls over your eyes where you're really not processing and not taking a lot of this in. So all of those things that you're telling that poor family in the beginning, you're going to probably have to tell them again. And you're probably going to have to be patient because you're probably going to have to tell them a second time or a third time because they're still processing so much about what just happened and how their life turned from good to really bad and really scary. The hardest part for me, I think, was having my kids come and see their dad. Nobody wants to see their dad in a coma. And I kept thinking Bob would wake up. And he wasn't waking up. He was getting worse. He was kicking. He was becoming more agitated. At one point in time, he was biting one of the corpsmen who would be posted by his bedside at all times so that he wouldn't try and get out of bed. He would try to get out of bed all the time. And it was my daughter, Catherine, who at the time was 12. My kids at the time were 14, 12, 5, and 5. So we lived in New York. We live in New York. So they were there. And I was down in Bethesda in Washington with Bob at the military hospital. So I don't know what you do without family and friends to step in, and they did. And when you go through something like this, and many of you have, you understand the power of those friendships and of community and of the ways that people take care of one another. And behind every one of those family members you see walking in the door to be with their loved one, your patient, is a whole army of people probably helping to support them in the community. And that's a really, really wonderful thing. My daughter came in to the room first, and we would bring everybody around to his good side because his left side was pretty scary. And she bent down and began to talk to him and tell him about her day. And then she said, "Dad, let's play the kissing game." And that was their game that they would play when he would be on the road covering stories. They would both kiss into the receiver for as long as they could. Before they said goodbye, and he would always let her win. He would always pull away first. And so she began to kiss his good cheek, and about 5 seconds later, a tear came out of his good eye. And that was the very first sign that we had 2.5 weeks into his coma, that maybe he was in there, that maybe he heard us, that maybe this would be okay. And I'll never forget what the nurse said to me then, because I, of course, screamed for the nurse, so I needed some proof from this. And she came in and she said, "You know, it's always the children that can get to these guys." And it was all men that were in the ward at that time. She said, "It's the midnight snuggles and the cuddles and the love and the connection that a parent has between a child. It's always the kids that can reach them." And I thought that was a really, really beautiful thing. And then about 2 clicks later, I thought, "Well, what about the wives who've been married to them for 18 years? Why can't I reach him?" I would come in, I would touch his, you know, face and hair, and it was hard to get around him with all those tubes. There was a point in time toward the end when I would crawl in bed next to him because I just couldn't stand it anymore. The power of human touch is an incredible, incredible thing. Bob and I visit many VA hospitals where the wounded are, and there's a young man named Jose who's undergoing probably his fourth craniotomy. He's had so many infections. He's nonverbal. He's in really bad shape. So we went in to visit Jose, and I just began to rub his feet because it was pretty much the only place on his body I could get to. But I just was rubbing his feet and rubbing his feet. And his mother, Nellie, who's been through an awful lot, as we were leaving, gave me a big hug, and she said, "Thank you for touching him like a person." She said, "Everybody comes in here, and it's all medical touching. It's taking this reading, and it's, you know, pulling out this tube and checking this." And she said, "You touched him like a human being. And when you did that, I could see how he reacted. I could just see that you made him feel not like a patient, but like a human." So I know you have to touch and you have to prod and you have to do many things and get many measurements and check. But every now and then, think about that little foot rub. Think about that touch that you give to that patient on the shoulder that makes them feel not like a patient, but maybe like the human being that they were before their accident, the human being that they so desperately want to be again. Because your power, that Mount Olympus stuff I told you about before, it's also in your touch, not just in your words. And that's an important thing to remember as well. Well, when I touched Bob and I would say things to him, then one of the neurologists who has since been removed from her position, she was a clinician, and by that I mean she really only worked with numbers, so she probably wasn't the right person to be counseling families. But she said to me, I said, "Look, you know," she said to me actually, You must really have him trained well, because when you come in here, I can see, and you say things and talk to him, I can see sort of his heart rate go up, and he really listens to you." And I said, "Is it trained, or is it just maybe because he loves me and likes to hear my voice?" And she said, "Oh, I guess I hadn't really thought about that." Wah, wah. Okay, new person, please. She was also the person on day one from him coming out of his coma who had done the quick sort of cognitive test with him. And instead of maybe parsing the information like, "Okay, you know what? We didn't do so well today, but each day it gets better." Instead, she said the words that will still ring through my head. I can still pull them up immediately, which were, "Well, we've looked at the results, and 99.5% of 45-year-old males are smarter than your husband." And I thought, let's flip that a little bit, okay? Let's find another way to say that, which all sort of harks back to kind of my general point about it's how you present the information. Bob woke up on day 36, where I was at my lowest moment. I had put my kids back on a van to the airport. They were crying. I was crying. "Mommy, why can't you come home with us? Daddy's not waking up. We need you. He doesn't need you." Very difficult thing. One of Bob's neurosurgeons in New York said to me, "There's something about the 5-week mark with families." And he sees this routinely, whether somebody's flown in from Kansas City to get a heart transplant, whatever it is, at about 5 weeks, if a family is separated and they're going through something difficult, especially a medical journey, that's about the point that things begin to fall apart. And I found that to be true in our own case. I was getting a lot of pressure from the government to keep Bob within the VA rehab system. I was told that he needed to be rehabbing with other soldiers who had been in a war zone. The famous words to me were, "Do you really want him in a New York hospital with other people who have stroked out while chewing meat at, the 21 Club?" And I thought, well, he's not a soldier. He's not a military person. And I didn't know what to do. That was probably one of the most stressful junctures for me. The military hospital they wanted to send him to was Tampa, which is one of the centers of excellence in the VA system for brain injury. And we were at the 5-week mark, my children were crying, and all of a sudden the decision became crystal clear. This family is not going to be a part anymore. Families, whether or not we were going to sacrifice quality in his rehab care, which of course we didn't, because just like Boston, New York has fabulous rehab hospitals, it wasn't going to matter to me that what we were maybe going to sacrifice by not going civilian or not going VA, I knew we would totally make up by just having the family together, by just having us all be around him and motivating him, by him having his children be able to sit on his lap, by him being able to look at his family and say, "This is what I want to get better for." I saw a lot of young men in the hospital, in the ICU, who didn't have family around them. This is the highest percentage of orphans in any standing army that we've ever had. And I worry about those guys when they get out of the hospital and they go back to Nebraska to their trailer or their small home, and there's nobody like me, no Nurse Ratched, to sort of say, you put that TV clicker down right now, we're going to go through these flashcards. I worry about what happens to them, because families heal together. Families heal when they're a unit. And that was the smartest move that I made, was taking him back to New York and then beginning the long, long road to rehab. I'll never forget looking at a rehab facility in Johns Hopkins, because we were still trying to figure out where to go and where was the best and what were we going to do, and walking in the room and seeing the car and bursting into tears and turning to the doc who was with me and saying, I didn't think his issues were going to be physical. I thought this was about speech and language. And he sort of looked at me and said, but, you know, the brain's the computer for your whole body. And it was at that point that I had said to Bob's doc, okay, tell me everything. I'm ready to hear it all. I want to sit in this room with you, and I want you to tell me everything that you think is going to happen to Bob based on your experience with other people. And we spent about an hour with him just giving me all of the bad stuff, and that was how I wanted to deal. I originally didn't want to know anything until Bob woke up and we could see what his baseline was. That was the way I just had decided to treat this. Did he remember us? Did he love us? Could he speak? Where was he at? Don't tell me the bad stuff until I know where we're starting from. But he wasn't waking up. So I had asked to try to learn everything that I could learn. And I got everything sort of front end loaded at a time when I think I was more ready to hear it. The other amazing thing about information, about how smart we are and how we ultimately are going to realize if it's not going to go our way, the other thing is that after something cataclysmic has happened to you, your definition of triumph completely changes. My definition of triumph for Bob had been, I don't know, go stand live at Katrina and do a 30-minute newscast with no notes and stand up. My new definition for Bob was to say a full sentence without screwing a word up. And when I say that that was triumphant, I mean that. That was like the gold medal at the Olympics. And so you have minimized your expectations. They change, which is the absolute other reason not to beat somebody over the head with all the negative stuff. Because you begin to look for the little things, and you'll take that. And then you get a little greedy, and then you want a little more. And as you watch this person advance down the continuum of their rehabilitation after a brain injury, you become their greatest champion, and you realize how vastly different your goals are for that person than they were pre-injury. But you accept that. You've internalized that. That becomes part of who you are and who you are as a couple or who you are as a family. One of the greatest things about the rehab hospital, I thought, was when Bob actually started, you know, going to rehab, and there was the kitchen and the bed, and I said, but, like, guys, this is never stuff that he did before. You're rehabbing him, and you're like, are you really going to have him make beds? And they made chicken satay one night. And they said, well, this is just part of, you know, doing measurements and getting back to everyday living. And then I thought, opportunity, okay? I'm going to tell him that he did this every night. You made your bed every morning, don't you remember? Oh, my God, you were like a cordon bleu chef. You made dinner every night. Didn't work. Just so you know, it didn't work. I found his memory during the coma really selective. I have people who told me they remembered every single thing said over them at a bedside. And Bob actually remembered nothing. He remembered nothing, but he had a vivid dream that he can remember. And the other weird thing that happened, we got many wonderful notes and letters. We got boxes and boxes and boxes of letters from viewers and people Bob had interviewed and people around the world. And one of the people that wrote to Bob was Bruce Springsteen, who had heard that Bob was a fan. And so he sent Bob a bunch of DVDs and a nice letter and said, you know, when you get better, come to a concert. I really admire your work and I want to meet you. And so I sometimes, when I would have the time, and man, life moved 99 miles an hour in the ICU. If I thought I'd be sitting there reading him, you know, sweet little poems and stuff, it did not work that way. Luckily, there were other people in my posse who could do that. But every now and then I would read him some letters when I would have some time alone with him in the morning. So I took the Bruce letter. I thought, he's in a coma. He's not going to know if I switch this around a little bit. So I said, hey, honey, listen, Bruce Springsteen says that if you wake up, he'll come down here and play for you and the soldiers. No reaction. So on day two of waking up from the coma, he suddenly sat up in bed, and he said, I need one of those nanairs. And we said, okay, that's a guitar. You need a guitar. Great, whatever you want. We'll get it. But why do you need a guitar? And he said, well, I have to be ready to play when that boss man comes. So I thought, really, you remember that from the coma? But not like, you're safe, I love you, everything's okay. No memory of that whatsoever. So that costs some big jewelry, I'm going to tell you that right now. That was another really disturbing thing, too, and I know that you in the rehab world don't do that, but having people talking over your comatose husband as if he's not there, as if he's not a person, I would make them say, you know what, you can say it to him, too, or you can look at him. The biggest word in this entire journey that you can never, ever, ever forget is the D word, and that's not divorce, even though I think the divorce rate is incredibly high. That's dignity, dignity. Give that patient dignity, and give that caregiver and that family member dignity. Dignity is still a huge part of what we're about. If I can see Bob is just cruising along and he's missing the word, and I know he's going to miss the word, or I can hear him about to miss the word, he's actually such a bright man that he can often substitute a synonym for what he's looking for, but names are really hard. And so gently by his side, hopefully with dignity, I simply supply the word. And if you can go through your day giving that patient the dignity that was afforded them when they were operating pre-injury, then you will be giving not only that patient, but that family and that family member and their loved ones the same amount of dignity by the way that you simply treat them. One of the other things that I wanted to share with you about the rehab journey is I wasn't there. I wasn't there. I not only had 4 kids at home and a career which I had just completely put on hold for about a year, but I went with him for about 3 days, and it was the most painful thing that I ever did. It was so incredibly hard for me to sit at the fake store and watch him look at the plastic lettuce and be unable to come up with that word, or to read the little short story and have to choose from A, B, and C answers, and to see him struggling over it. And this was really early on, but what I realized very early on is that I wasn't giving him any dignity by sitting there watching over him. He could probably see my face, which was probably going like, oh, God, it's me, please pick me. That was the most unhelpful thing I could do. And so while I saw plenty of other wives there, and certainly a lot of mothers, and had I been his mother, I absolutely would have been there all day. And sadly, I knew far too many mothers doing that right now. But as his wife, I chose to treat this as if this was his job. He would go off to work in the morning, to his rehab, and that was kind of his job, and that was his time and space away from me, and I would get the stuff done at the house that I needed. I would pack the kids' lunches. I would welcome them when they came home and try to make that as normal as possible, and I didn't have to see him failing, and he didn't have to see me see him failing. And so when you see those folks walking through the rehab world, and maybe they don't have a spouse or a partner there, don't judge. That may be one of the most helpful choices that that couple has made to be able to make that journey and come out with a measure of respect and dignity for one another. So I felt like I had to explain that, but they all completely understood it. And they all felt that Bob did better when he could just operate one-on-one with them. It's sort of like, I felt like I was behind the, you know, if you're in a one of those marketing studies where there's people sitting behind the window. I felt like I was that person. And I didn't want to be that person to my husband. I didn't want to be spying on him. And they actually said that when I stepped away and we both went in our opposite orbits, that he felt, I think, a much greater sense of relief to fail and to try harder and to just be sort of himself and develop relationships, personal relationships with his therapist. That probably wouldn't have happened as well if I had been sort of watching over his entire, you know, 6 or 4 hours of therapy, whatever it was. Well, little by little, Bob began to put his words back together, and his cognitive function came back together. I'm trying to think to tell you what was his math skills were always there. We were just kind of comparing notes in the corner. It was really his language. It was really his aphasia that was his biggest issue. But it was really incredible to see how quickly that began to put itself back together. We hired someone from the local rehab facility to come in on weekends, on Saturday, to continue his language. Ultimately, his cognitive rehab was structured around what he did. So he stopped cooking and making beds, which didn't last very long, and began to read the New York Times. And then his job was really to take an article from the New York Times and rewrite it, because, of course, that was his cognitive rehab tailored to what he did in his profession. And that also gave him a measure of dignity. He struggled so hard with that in the earlier days. And I would walk into his neuropsychologist's office. This is back in New York. This was a really great one, not the wah-wah one. And I remember having just this moment of despair. I had many moments of despair, but I crystal clear remember this one and just kind of breaking down. And I said, what's going to happen to us? And she literally had a crystal ball on her desk, and she pushed the crystal ball over to me, and she said, I can't tell you what's going to happen. You just have to stay in your own world of hope and faith. But here's what I can show you. I can show you this writing sample from his cog therapy 2 weeks ago, and I can show you the one he just did this week. So concretely, I was able to read this one and read this one, and it was a little bit better. And that was what I needed. That was all I needed, was some kind of proof from his therapists that things were moving in the right direction. Maybe not as fast as I wanted them to. I wanted it to all be healed overnight. But just the fact that his therapists could show me and tell me and talk to me about progress was a huge part of my own healing. I'm going to wind this up in a sec, and I just want to say that I think the really hardest part was after we got him home from rehab and he was doing his outpatient rehab, because that's when I fell apart. That's when the adrenaline gave out. There's a fabulous line in the Joan Didion book, Year of Magical Thinking, where she just likens what happens to her after her husband's death, and she gets through the funeral and she gets through the grieving, and then she likens herself really to a car where the engine has just been flooded, that she has pressed the accelerator so many times that she's just simply flooded all of the mechanisms. And that's how I felt. I'd gotten us through this incredibly rocky journey. He had woken up. He was getting better. He was on the course for rehab. But I was simply out of gas. And it was at that one of those moments when I went into the rehab facility, I think, to pick him up. And that was when his OT looked at me and she said, come in my office just for a second. And that's when she said, has anybody asked you how you're doing lately? And that's when I probably used like a box of Kleenex at that. You know, she sort of shut the door. And she gave me a 10-minute shoulder massage that I will never, ever, ever forget, ever. And that little moment of kindness, when I talk about those moments that you intersect with somebody, and to you it's just not really a big deal because you've been giving shoulder massages all day. But to me, that was the most glorious thing that any human being could have done at that moment in life. And that gave me that little sort of shot that I needed to get through probably that next week. Somebody cared about me in the equation. Somebody just asked how I was, because I wasn't doing well. That's the last part. And actually, in the book Perfectly Imperfect, there's a chapter called Chutes and Ladders toward the end. And that's my chapter about the journey as the caregiver after the injury has happened. So if you remember that child's game of you roll the dice and you go up the ladder, then something happens. Maybe he's having a bad day, it's a fatigue day or whatever it was. I would go all the way down the chute and negate all of the progress that I had just made. And I write very honestly in that chapter about situational depression, about the fact that things happen in our lives that are simply bigger than we are, and that it's okay to go talk to somebody. The stigma that we have on mental illness in this country, it needs to be erased, and it certainly needs to be erased for those in the caregiving continuum and those going through hard situations. It was my mother who finally said, you know, Lee, I think you need to go talk to somebody and you need to get on an antidepressant. And I fought it and I fought it. I'm not a pill kind of gal. I'm a half glass full kind of gal. I could always cheer myself up. I couldn't do it at this point in time. This was the man that I loved. We were supposed to head down the road of life together, and we'd worked so hard for him to get where he was. And our entire life had been upended, and there was absolutely no guarantee about where this was going to go. I mean, can you think of a worse situation than trying to tell a wife that life is going to be okay after a brain injury, because nobody can tell you anything? It depends on so many individual factors that you all know and I don't even have to go into. But that waiting, that patience thing, that's really hard to do. And so I did. I got what my neuropsychologist or Bob's neuropsychologist called body armor. I went on Paxil or whatever it was or something, and I write about that. I was worried that all of a sudden I would be sort of singing the battle hymn of the Republic in the shower if I went on this stuff. And I really wasn't. I was really me. I felt like it was a trampoline that stopped me from going through the floor. All of a sudden, there I was, waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning, like Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. I was short of breath. There were things flying at me, my thoughts, my fears. How are we going to have to sell the house? I'll have to go back to work full time. What are we going to do about college? We haven't saved any of this money. A journalist makes really no money until you get to the top. So it wasn't like we had our life all set. And I had never thought that those things would happen to me. I was always a fairly capable person. So I urge you to read that chapter because I think it gives you an insight into the other side of it and into the caregiver side. And then the very last chapter is called What I Know Now. And that's my 10 kind of tips, what to do, what to say, what not to say when someone's going through a difficult time. And that was really gleaned from being on the road from these last two books for the last 2 years and having everybody tell me my stories, their stories. My favorite one still is my friend whose father died and was home for the first Thanksgiving after his death and ran into an older woman she knew in town in the grocery store who came up to her and said, I am so sorry about your dad. I know just how you feel. My cat died last Thanksgiving. So things like God doesn't give you more than you can handle. Things happen for a reason. Unless you've stood in those shoes, some of these things may sound really great and they look good on a Hallmark card, but as the caregiver, when you've heard them a million times, you can't think of a reason why a really good man gets blown up by a bomb in Iraq. So that I think that will also help you. I talk about the power of human touch. I talk about telling it like it is. This stinks, I wanted people to say to me. Not, oh, you know, you're so strong. If I heard you're so strong one more time, I thought I would throw up right on their shoes. But of course you keep it together. Of course you're lovely and you're gracious. But there are just things that are much more meaningful to say to someone. I'm going to just end really briefly by giving you my net-net. And then I often get asked, what did I learn? Where are we now? And by the way, we're in a really wonderful place now, and Bob's aphasia is still there, and he still does have fatigue. And I think the only other little residual thing is probably his temper is slightly shorter, his fuse is slightly shorter than it was before. Other than that, his personality is unchanged, which is absolutely incredible. He still has a really lousy sense of humor. I mean, he's just not funny. He thinks he's funny. And his reading is slower. It's definitely slower. And sometimes I'll actually see him moving his lips to just kind of to take it all in. He has never really had serious depression from this. I think that he feels still that he is so lucky to be alive. He has seen so many who didn't make it and knows how many in our military didn't make it, and I think that carries him a long way. I don't know how that differs from somebody who got in the car accident and feels lucky to be alive or feels cheated or ripped off. Maybe that comes from somewhere deep down in who you are and your DNA, but that was not the way he processed this journey. Not to say I haven't seen him have his moments where he's sad or he understands just the enormity of what he lost, but for the most part, we are very grateful for what we've been left with. So how is my life different? There are a heck of a lot more dishes in my sink. I still sweat the small stuff sometimes, but I can put it back in perspective so much more easily. And one of the things I've learned walking in the world of brains is that the average amount of time that a human being stays in the present is 7 seconds. So you need to try that when you're driving home or walking home or whatever. Think about it. You're in the present. Oh, look at the beautiful color of the leaves today. I love this time of spring. Like, you just can't get a dress that color green. It's just the neatest color green. Oh, shoot, I forgot to marinate the chicken for dinner tonight. Or, oh, got to get that memo on my boss's desk. And so we toggle back and forth between past and present and future. And what we all need to learn to do, because there really are no guarantees in life, I could walk out of here and get hit by a bus right on Commonwealth Avenue. And if I didn't learn to stretch that 7 seconds, if I didn't learn to sit in my kitchen with my coffee cup when they're all asleep at 5:30 in the morning and think, this is when I love them best, but they're all safe and they're all home and they're all sleeping and I'm such a lucky person in the end. If we didn't learn to just kind of be in the moment, then we're constantly somewhere else. So in my life, what the big miracle of Bob's recovery did more than anything was to widen the aperture inside of me to witness the presence of small, everyday blessings. The big moments are easy to spot, but the real challenge, the art form, is to find gratitude in much simpler things. We need to be open to feeling the power of a life made up of many little shards of white light experiences. These moments of grace, as I think of them, are as real and as powerful as the headliners. I see these little blessings in the gift of a friend's healthy newborn baby, a clean mammogram, or the really truly satisfying snatches of conversation I have with my father now when he's having a good day and can clearly remember the parts of his life. People talk a lot about living in the moment, but to do that, to really achieve that, is to be able to fully participate in all the unarticulated goodness that makes up our lives. And of course, that kind of focus isn't possible every single day. But I try now to give it all my attention when I tiptoe into my children's bedrooms in the morning and stroke their hair as I wake them for school. I count my blessings for having sisters and girlfriends with whom I can unburden and be as comfortable with as a second skin. It is one of life's small gifts to be able to ease someone's pain, to hold their fears for an hour or a day. That's what you all do. None of us would ever choose to rupture the veil of innocence that shelters our children, and as a parent, I would have liked to have spared them from the worst of it. But that's ultimately not realistic. You cannot protect them all of the way. That's not how life works, and that's okay. But in the grateful aftermath of our family's collective sorrow, I tell myself that my kids have learned more from the difficulties and the hardships they have witnessed and endured than they ever would have otherwise. The routes my children constructed to navigate around the fear and loss surrounding their father's injury have forged their capacity to truly engage in their own lives, to be empathetic, and to genuinely care for others. I have no doubt that they can already handle situations far beyond what many of their peers can. 4 years after Bob's injury, we have all come out the other side, each member of my family. We are all unexpected experts at surviving. We're no different than so many American families. We've acquired scars, opened our eyes. We've grown and stretched. We've ached and rejoiced. We've felt loss keenly, and we've counted our many blessings. None of us will ever underestimate the power of love, family, faith, friendship, and the resilience of the human spirit. And through it all, we've been grateful to have kept our sense of humor and our general optimism intact. We may be messy at the edges some days, like today, me putting my makeup on here in the bathroom when I got here. But we're a family firmly united at our core. And in the end, we are proud to be wonderfully, perfectly imperfect. So thank you for listening to my long-winded story.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Lee Woodruff, wife of ABC News correspondent Bob Woodruff. Tonight's lecture was titled, Life Changes in an Instant, A Caregiver's Journey, and was presented by the Boston University College of Health and Rehabilitation Sciences Sargent College. Mrs. Woodruff was introduced by Sargent College Dean Gloria Waters. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Alden Fertig. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Begger. Thanks for joining us.